covering a few cool topics today. One of my favorite hobby horses that we've been dealing with for a little while now, which is that we're going to be talking to Katie Gibbs, who's with Science Uncensored. This Katie was also our guest a while ago as well, to representing the Death of Evidence rally, which was a kind of faux funeral for evidence that happened in Ottawa. We're going to be speaking to Katie again today because apparently this issue hasn't gone away. Apparently there are still many scientists in Ottawa and throughout Canada who are upset about the limits that are placed on their ability to both work with government scientists and non-government scientists, as well as simply accessing information that our own tax dollars pay for. Katie's going to join us in the first half of the program to talk about that. In the second half of the program, of course, we're going to hear Kevin Farmer throughout, but we will be hearing later on from Alan Ackerman. Alan Ackerman is a professor of English here at the University of Toronto. Normally, we don't deal with we try not to deal with issues that are so sort of local and close to home. This is Canada's environmental, but it's just so darn close that we just kind of had to. We're actually literally talking about, if you happen to be familiar with U of T campus, we're here in Hart House. We're talking about astroturfing the backfield. So literally about 40 feet off the property, or 40 feet outside of Hart House here. This is an issue. We're going to talk to Alan about why he is upset about this plan to basically astroturf the backfield and remove some green space. We'll talk about some of the opposition to that. And I think it's something that's highly relevant, which is just in general the sort of falsifying, the plastification, the denaturalization of our landscape. You know, we already want lots of things that are green, and we're talking about things here that are being changed from actual plants to just sort of green paint and varnish. We're going to talk to Alan about that later in the program, but first we're going to have to take a quick just music break as we do an intro here and just take care of a quick technical issue here. So we're going to go to track 4 for a minute. This is just going to be Tragically Hip just for a minute while we get our technical issue sorted out.
She loves me not.
All right. Burn blue on the sea, loose and bleed under sky, so smoky blue green. I can't foresee a Dixie did she, so we dance the sidewalk clean. My memory is muddy, what's this river that I'm in? New Orleans a sinking man and I don't want to swim. And I'm told, what's wrong? What's going on?
Get started now, however. Do we have Katie there on the line? Sure. Katie, are you there? Oh, we'll have to get the volume turned up on you a little bit there, Katie.
Okay, one sec.
There we go. Yeah.
So, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now. Thank you so much for joining us, Katie Gibbs, with the University of Ottawa. You're a PhD student in the biology department. Do you wish to add anything to your resume?
Well, I'm actually no longer. I finished in September.
Oh, congratulations.
So, yeah, thank you.
And sorry, but congratulations.
Former PhD student.
So where are you working now, Katie?
So I'm actually executive director of Evidence for Democracy.
Well, I'm glad to hear that that's continued to
so that's
strongly.
That's essentially the group that has formed out of the Death of Evidence rally.
Absolutely. So why not, I think that's a perfect place to start. I mean, the general concept is one that is something that I harp on the show quite frequently, which is that there seems to be something. I don't know anything about the legality of it. I'm not a law or a policy expert per se. But it's something that sort of, as a Canadian, feels instinctively like it shouldn't be legal, which is taking tax dollars to fund research that goes towards things. Again, as you point out, and as I've pointed out many times in the show, we're not talking about issues of national security here. This isn't weapons research. It's not top secret, you know, terrorism activities. We're talking about like soil analysis and stuff like that, and like the cleanliness of groundwater and genetic information about bison and stuff like that, that is either being totally blacklisted from the public or being put on the other side of a field on, you know, being in the middle is about 5,000 hurdles. Exactly. That's something that I've been upset at for a little while, and clearly you're upset about it too, because you're now directing an entire group that's focused on that. But
yeah.
I mean, that's sort of been my rant. Why don't you tell the story in your own words?
Well, I mean, the things you point out are very much true. The current government has put in place new policies that are very sweeping in nature, that pretty much any media requests that come in, it doesn't matter what it's about, either has to go to a departmental manager or sometimes even to the Privy Council office in Ottawa, which is really quite mind-blowing. So even for the cases that you point out, things like bison genes, snowfall patterns, really any questions at all that come in from the media to our scientists are now rerouted to comms people, and the scientists are just not allowed to answer at all. I think most Canadians would find this alarming. I'm also not a lawyer, so I don't know about the legality, but whether it's legal or not,
it feels like, as a taxpayer, it feels like it should be. I mean, that's sort of my reaction.
Exactly. I mean, I see it as, this is public science. This is our science. We've paid for it. Like, it inherently belongs to the public because we've paid for, you know, the research expenses. We pay the salary of these scientists.
I think a lot of the time that sort of aspect gets lost on people. And I just want to interrupt you again for a minute, just sort of to emphasize what I think is sort of the most important point here, which is that I think it's really, really important if you're thinking about this issue, if this is something that a listener hasn't come across or they're not really aware of. I think someone could take the opinion of, well, okay, here's a bunch of, you know, a few small scientists that are upset because, you know, who knows what actually happened, but they're upset and sort of say, you know, and basically, as someone who isn't in sort of aware of what's actually going on, say, well, this is just like teachers' strikes. It's all politics. You know, some people say, yay, teachers. Some people say, you know, the government should make cuts, and it's just a he said, she said, and, you know, whatever, and basically blow the whole thing off. But that's from the point of view of the fact that I think a lot of people or the people who aren't upset about this are viewing it from the perspective of, well, the government has information and they give us some of it when it's useful, but basically this is their thing. They're doing stuff with it. It's theirs. But the entire concept of the government is that they're serving the people. The only time when the government has a moral or legal right to hold things from the public, at least in the sense of the intention of democracy, is that they, you know, for instance, there are valid reasons to say that something is of national security. So the government withholds information because it genuinely is to the public's benefit not to be aware of certain details.
Yeah, absolutely.
But other than that, there's no argument. Yeah, and I think people have the balance. The assumption is on the wrong side. The assumption
is
we should have access to everything unless there's a good reason, rather than vice versa.
Exactly. And if you take a look at the actual letter that we have on Science Uncensored that people can send to the government, it makes that case as well. It makes the case that there may be cases where it is in the best interest of the public to not necessarily have all the facts. But in those cases, the onus is still on the government to show why that's a special case. So it's exactly, you're right, the default has been swapped, whereas the default should be that everything is open and available to the public, except in the few cases where it makes sense for it to not be. Whereas right now we're seeing the complete opposite, where everything, regardless of how mundane it might be, is sort of behind this, you know, communications firewall. So I think, yeah, you're completely right. It doesn't belong to the government. And it is actually a little bit ironic that it's a conservative government that you would think, you know, believes in sort of small government principles.
We commonly see that fiction is a fiction on a daily basis.
Yeah,
almost.
Exactly,
I mean, there's claims of what conservatives want. And the thing, this was something I was thinking about this morning when I was sort of reading through preparing for the interview, was there's actually a lot of conservative positions that I totally take. I'm not a psycho left-wing liberal on every issue by any means. It's the fact that the conservatives we're talking about in this case don't adhere to those principles. They're not actually conservatives in a lot of cases.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, in Harper's case specifically, he ran on a platform of transparency and accountability. And that's really something that we're trying to get across with the Science Uncensored campaign as well, that if you believe in a transparent and accountable government, then, you know, these extra barriers to the open communication of our scientists just don't make any sense. So, yeah, there's that issue of, you know, the public has paid for this. It's our science. We should be able to access it. But then there's also the other side of it that, you know, it's a foundation of our democracy to have informed public debate. And in order to have an informed public debate, we need to, at the very least, have the scientific information available. You know, that is really what drives our democracy. You can't have a government that's only releasing information that goes along with their ideology or their agenda. That's not right.
You're kind of missing both parts there. You're missing the informed public part, and you're missing the debate part. I mean, as we saw these sort of bills that went through recently, there was no debate on any of this stuff. It just got rammed through.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, I need to take a minute here because we're skating dangerously close to something that, you know, well, it's not like illegal for me to do at CIUT is sort of one of my personal values, which is that we as a show and me personally do not support or are against any particular party. What my complaint is here is what the government that happens to be in charge right now is doing. I would be just as upset if anyone else was doing it.
And
I just want to make that absolutely clear. This isn't a like anti-conservative or anti-Harper sort of interview.
No, and
it just ends up being that way by default.
Well, but it goes back to what we're saying. I mean, there are absolutely a lot of people in Canada who would identify themselves as conservatives and who likely even voted for Harper, who would be upset by what's going on. And even there have been a lot of conservative people who've spoken out about it. So I think, you know, this issue of, you know, transparency and accountability and allowing our scientists to speak freely to the public, that absolutely crosses partisan lines.
So let's go through some of the specific details here, because again, like I was saying before, like someone who maybe is just sort of reading the headline on this, or maybe they took a brief look at your website but didn't really go through it, or maybe they don't have some of the context for what it is that we're talking about. So it doesn't sound like we're just sort of like randomly picking on people. Let's go through
absolutely.
Some of the specifics. So
absolutely. Well, first off, that's partly why we made the website, because this is a really difficult story to follow, because it's really a story that's been playing out over like 5 years. Right? So you see it on the news now and then, but each individual story isn't all that alarming. What is alarming is the context, and when you put all of those individual cases together is when you really see this bigger picture that is quite alarming. So that's partly why we did the website, was so that, you know, people would have a place where they could go and see the chronology of what has been happening. So if we talk about some of the most recent ones, because they're sort of really what was the impetus for doing the website as well, is the new rules actually go even further than just limiting communication of scientists to the public and the media. So at DFO in February, they put in new rules about how scientists are allowed to go about publishing their papers. So previously, the new rules only applied to papers that were written by government scientists. Whereas now the new rules also apply to any papers that the scientists have collaborated with non-governmental scientists as well. So that's really a huge new reach as well, that even if you collaborate with like an academic scientist, you're still going to have to go through these new rules. And the biggest change is that now, instead of the actual scientist signing off on the form after they've submitted their research to a journal, it's already gone through peer review, the journal has accepted it and said, yes, this is good science, we want to publish it, then at that point, there's just sort of like a copyright form that needs to be signed. And previously, the scientist signed that. And under the new rules, that has to go to a departmental manager to sign it. And so the concern there is that they could use this essentially as a way to stall or prohibit this work from actually being published, even after it's already gone through the peer review process.
So there's specific things in here where, I mean, my personal reaction is anytime I hear the word conspiracy, my stomach churns and my eyes roll back in my head, because I just don't really have any time of day for conspiracy theories. But there's specific things in here that really seem rather Orwellian. Let me get you to talk about just for a minute about the science conferences and their quote unquote handlers.
So the main example from that was at a polar conference last year. So for people who aren't scientists, you know, scientists often go to scientific conferences. That's where you get a chance to talk to all the other scientists in your field, share ideas in a really sort of fluid manner, form new collaborations. It's really a crucial part of the scientific process. And so what we were seeing last year was the case of a scientist who was going to this polar year conference, and the government actually sent a media relations officer or handler to attend the conference with her and literally, like, follow her around the whole time at the conference and monitor what she was saying to people and make sure that she didn't speak to the press. And that, I mean, that's really unheard of. I hadn't ever heard of anything like that happening before.
So when we're talking about, like, leashing scientists, we're almost getting pretty close to that being literal.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there wasn't a physical tether between the two of them, but...
There might as well have been.
Yes, exactly.
So, I mean, I don't want to get the gentleman in trouble because it's obviously nothing specific to do with him. So I'm going to make this really, really vague, just so I don't get anybody in trouble. I don't think he deserves it. You know, he's just doing his job. But there was a gentleman from a government agency that I was talking about at a conference I went to that should help mm-hmm. protect him. But where I'm rather friendly. People find a lot, and I'm pretty good at getting people to talk to me. And so we walked up and they're like, "Hey, where was CIUT?" And, you know, so none of their like emergency buzzers go off because I didn't say, you know, the Star or Globe and Mail or anything like that. So it was like CIUT. So I think maybe his defenses were still down. And I started asking questions about policy and, you know, how does the government approach this or that issue? And he was like, "Oh, Paul, yeah." And then after about 5 or 6 minutes, because I was really enjoying this, I love talking to government types about how decisions get made and about policy direction and that. About 5 or 6 minutes into it, you could slowly start to see his brow sort of thicken. And then by the end of it, we're like, "Great, thanks so much for your time." And he's like, "Hang on a second, let me give you my card. Would you just do me a favor and just email me before this goes to air?" Mm-hmm. I said, yeah, no problem. I'd be more than happy to. Like, we're here to cooperate with everybody. I'm just, you know, we're just here to spread information. I'm not trying to push a certain point or anything. And then I got an email from him later. He's like, "Yeah, you can't lose any of that or I'm going to lose my job." And again, I have to protect his identity, but that was a true story that happened to me.
Well, you know, our government scientists, they are completely terrified. I've spoken to many of them myself, especially, you know, I've been trying to find people who will speak out because it will help bring attention to this if we can put a personal face on some of these people. And even a lot of the ones who've been laid off, you know, there's been a lot of scientists laid off recently as well, so I was hoping that maybe they would be willing to speak out. But they're even worried about losing their severance package if they speak out, even though they're no longer employed with the government. And just, you know, if people are saying, "Well, you know, maybe this is reasonable," I think it's also really important to compare this to what's going on in the U.S. and the U.K., where they're moving in the complete opposite direction that we are. In the U.S., they've put in place clear policies that allow government scientists to speak to the media. All they have to do is, you know, start their interview by saying, "I'm not speaking on behalf of my department." Mm-hmm. And the example that I really like is you have James Hansen, who's, you know, a famous climate scientist.
He's one of my heroes, absolutely.
He's also the head of NASA, right? So he's a government scientist in a very important position at NASA. And, you know, he goes to all of the climate protests. He was recently arrested. He literally just took a vacation day from his job at NASA and got arrested at a protest, and they were fine with that. A government spokesperson said what he does in his off hours is up to him, whereas that's absolutely the opposite of what is happening here.
Yeah, if that was a Canadian scientist, him and pretty much everyone in his department would have been fired. I mean,
oh, absolutely.
at least that's how it feels.
I mean, even just at the Death of Evidence rally last summer, I heard from a lot of government scientists who sent me emails saying, you know, "We really support what you're doing. We would really love to come, but we're worried about losing our jobs if we attend the rally." And that's just attending a rally, whereas, you know, you have James Hansen in the U.S., one of the heads of NASA, just taking a vacation day and getting arrested at a rally. I mean, it's really the polar opposite.
Absolutely.
And even the Nature, which is a world-renowned science journal, they've written a few editorial articles, actually, about what's going on in Canada and how shocking it is. And they've really said it's been a complete role reversal with the U.S. in what we've seen in the past few years. So we're seeing, you know, similar things happening here to what was the case under Bush in the U.S. Whereas since Obama has come in the U.S., they've really done some great things with their science policy. And we've gone in the complete opposite direction.
Well, I think there's one general rule for people. If they don't want people to be upset about the bad things they're doing, find a way for them to stop finding out about them. And
exactly.
That seems to be the strategy here. I'm afraid we've got to go let you go. It was so much fun having you on the program today. You can see the sarcasm in my voice when I say I'm completely shocked that we agree across the board on all of this stuff.
Yeah.
But this has been one of my personal hobby horses. So I'm so happy that you guys are doing what you're doing, because you're actually focusing on something that's sort of like one of my top 10 issues. Just before we go here, do you want to give people information about how they can get involved, how they can check out your information, how they can contact you, all that good stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the best thing is to visit our website. It's www.scienceuncensored.ca. We have a lot of information there, so you can see for yourself the examples that have happened and make up your own mind if you think it's a reasonable communications plan or you think it's muzzling. And we have a form letter there that you can fill out as well to send a message to the government.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your time. Again, that was Katie Gibbs with Science Uncensored. You can check that out at scienceuncensored.ca or just do a Google search for The Death of Evidence. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, we're going to take a music break, and we'll be right back after this pause.
Here by my side, an angel. Here by my side, the devil. Never turn your back on me. Never turn your back on me again. Here by my side, it's heaven. Here by my side, you are destruction. Here by my side, a new color to paint the world. Ooh. Never turn your back on it. Never turn your back on it again. Here by my side, heaven. Here
All right, we are back. I'm Darren Kaster. You're listening to The Green Majority, Canada's all-environmental news hour. We're on broadcasting on 18 community stations coast to coast from Vancouver to St. John's. We've got Kevin Farmer now on the line as well. And actually, you know what? Before we go to Kevin, I should make a note. Normally, this is where in the show where I would say, oh, thank you so much for DJ Amber Waves for programming this much music. I want to make sure that everybody knows that she is not doing the music this week, which is what explains what sort of like unoriginal choices of music we have. I just got to say, I have no hate for Matthew Good or Tragically Hip or any of that stuff. Of course, that's why I chose them. But usually we have much more interesting music choices. So I just want to make sure that nobody blames this week's music on Amber because she's awesome. She's just taking the week off. So with that, with all that aside, Kevin Farmer, normally this is where I would also ask you what had gotten your ire this week. But you tipped me off on a couple of things. And I have to say, they definitely got my ire as well. So my question instead is, rather than what upset you this week, was which one would you like to start with?
I think what's been on my mind the most is the Resource Minister Joe Oliver, his PR trip south of the border to tout the Alberta oil. So he seems to be on a PR trip right now. He's hitting up industry groups and politicians, and he's claiming his line is that the Albertan tar sands, Albertan oil is green. he's like, it's just unbelievable. The right now, the pushback of the flashpoint is the Keystone XL pipeline. That's become sort of the flashpoint for the environmental movement right now. And that pipeline, it will essentially decide the fate of the tar sands in Canada, because Alberta is of course landlocked, and it's got to pipe its oil out if we're going to reach other markets. And there's opposition to the pipelines in Canada, the proposed and the existing pipelines in Canada being used to export this oil to either coast, and even just internally within Canada, there's just a lot of opposition to new pipelines, and there's growing opposition to dirty oil from Alberta, period. But it's as if some completely unimaginative person has said, well, the problem seems to be that the environmentalists don't like us, so let's just call it green.
I hear those stickers are coming off sticker rolls by the thousands in the dollar store these days. It's like a big green circle with the word green on it, and they're like, hey, look, it's green, it has a sticker.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. and he's I mean, talk about putting lipstick on a pig. just calling this stuff green and touting it, and he also has gone on to say that, you know, Canada. So the other attractive thing about oil from Canada is that we are politically stable. We've got a cozy sort of trade arrangement relationship with the States. And you know, a lot of their oil comes from politically unstable regions of the world where you just never know what might happen. And in some cases, like with Saudi Arabia, is oil from despotic regimes. Mm-hmm. that depend on. So, you know, so there's kind of this ethical thing about, you know, getting secure oil from Canada, and so to burnish Canada's credentials, he's also referred to Canada as an environmental champion.
As long as we're having opposite day, why not?
I just sort of fell over dead. Canada, an environmental champion? We're an environmental pariah. what has it been now? The last three COP conferences that we've won the colossal fossil award, or is it more than that now?
I'm pretty sure that we're the all-time reigning champion. I'd have to double check my numbers, but I'm pretty sure that as far back as they've been doing that, we are like orders of magnitude the leader on the Colossal Fossil Awards. But I will have to fact check that. That's off the top of my head. I don't know.
And they've been utterly well deserved. Like, we came by those honestly. And we're, just looking at the fact that we're the only country to have withdrawn from the Kyoto Accord. Now, admittedly, people are not reducing emissions. So, but we've actually gone out of our way to say we're not going to even bother trying to reduce emissions. We've got the most anemic targets. This government, the Harper regime, put forward the most anemic targets. They raised the baseline year up to 2006 from what I think it used to be 1997.
Mm-hmm.
So the baseline year for emissions is now 2006. So it's a further watering down the emissions target, and we're not on track to meet this. I don't even think we have a plan to meet this.
Well, I think we could go on for quite some time about all the failures here. But there was one that just before we have to move on, just because I have to move on to the next piece here to make sure we don't run out of time, would be that the one thing about that article that I wanted to sort of point out as well was that the idea was that the focus of it, if we're talking about the same one, I believe we are, was that the focus of it seemed to be the argument from the oil companies was there was some back and forth about whether or not this sort of study was legitimate, them saying, well, the environmental impact of this project versus the other projects we'll just do if you actually successfully cancel this one is negligible, and that this pipeline won't actually increase any export, you know, so basically they were trying to say, why are you fighting this? It doesn't make any difference. Seemed to be the thrust of it. And it was sort of like, hey, guy, like saying like, hey, environmentalists, or hey, citizens, we know that you don't really like this, but it turns out that stopping this won't actually change anything because we're just going to do other stuff and the effect is essentially the same, so don't bother. Which to me, I mean, for one, I mean, that's kind of funny, but for two, that seems like a huge admission that they know what they're doing is incredibly unpopular and that people are really, really upset about it, because their best argument is, oh yeah, well, if you cancel this, we'll just do something else. So what are you going to do about it? I mean, that seems to be the biggest admission of guilt ever.
Yeah, that's actually from a different article.
So I'm jumping ahead possibly slightly there. Anyway, I'm afraid we do have to move on, but Kevin, we're going to get you back right before we get to the end of the show. So we'll say adieu for now. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll hear from you a little bit later in the program. Right now, we're going to jump to Alan Ackerman, who I believe I have on the line. Are you there, Alan?
Yes, I am. Hello.
Thank you so much for joining the Green Majority today. As I introduced at the beginning of the feature, generally we're a nationally syndicated program. We're very thankful to have listeners all across the country and even some international. So generally we try and stay away from super local issues. But as I was introducing at the beginning of the show, this is so local that I can almost like throw my pen at the campus, at the area that we're talking about right now. So I felt like we should take some time to deal with it. And obviously has larger implications as well. So what came across my desk basically was I got an email about just a notice. I don't recall who it was. I believe it was from a mutual acquaintance of ours, Stephen Sharper. But it was just saying that basically there were some folks were upset about some changing over of some green space. And I said, well, you know, my initial reaction was kind of, what else is new? This sort of happens constantly. But it's a little bit more than that. And the issue is a little bit more fleshed out. So why don't you give us your sort of overview of exactly what it is that the university is trying to do here and the specific points that you feel that we're trying to stop this for? Why are you against it?
Well, I think this is a perfect case of thinking globally and acting locally and should be pertinent to people all over the country. Well, we're concerned about the plan at the University of Toronto because this is a very large green space on the downtown campus and one of the largest green spaces in the downtown core of Toronto. We're particularly concerned about questions of student access and actually access for the general public to the back campus. But we're also concerned about potential environmental sustainability impacts, tearing out a natural surface and putting in a synthetic turf creates very intense heat island impacts, which increases urban warming, let alone global warming. There are also impacts on water runoff. It's a very, very hard surface. And basically, they're taking out not only the grass, but all of the soil, replacing it with 36 inches of sterile fill, covered with porous asphalt, and then green nylon. We're also concerned because this is a heritage landscape, and the City of Toronto and the University of Toronto's own documents have designated it as a cultural heritage landscape, which has an important history in the city and also part of the history of the University of Toronto as well. So these are some among many of our concerns. Incidentally, we're also concerned because there's a brand new field hockey field that's just been built up in Brampton, and we're not sure why exactly we need to tear out this central urban green space to make two permanent Olympic-level field hockey fields, whereas this is a technically open space in the University of Toronto.
So there's a few key points there that I'd like you to get to you to explain a little bit further. So, I mean, my introduction of sort of calling it astroturfing isn't even correct enough. Can you just go over it again in a little bit more detail, like exactly what they're going to do? So they're going to be digging down, how deep did you say, into the backfield?
Well, more than 36 inches. AstroTurf, I believe, is a technical term that's used for a turf in the U.S., but this is a synthetic turf that's made of nylon, basically, and plastic. It's going to be covering a surface of porous asphalt, and underneath that, stone and tile. It has to be a very, very hard surface due to the requirements of high-level field hockey, and it's very specific for field hockey. So the manufacturer's own documentation indicates that there are many other usages that can't be, that is, casual uses that can't go on the field. And this also has a big impact on how, for example, a heavy rainstorm will run off because it's so hard. That water will run off very quickly into the ground sewage system. And also, as I said, you know, this, we already have a synthetic field just across the block at Varsity Field. In effect, this is turning the back campus into a field like the Varsity Field, even though the City of Toronto and U of T's own documentation makes a distinction between those two kinds of spaces. The heat island impact, as I mentioned before, has been proved by our own Professor John Danahy at the Faculty of Architecture, Landscape and Design. And he shows that the Varsity Field, for example, generates heats that can rise over 30 degrees Celsius higher than what the surrounding heat is in the city. So this has a big impact not only on, you know, people on campus, students and faculty and so forth, but also on anybody who lives in the downtown core, not to mention, you know, if one is concerned about global warming, and we would hope U of T would be a leader in environmentalism and be concerned about the planet, just as a role model, this contributes, even in principle, to the degradation of, you know, the environment.
So one of the things that that we just want to like kind of isolate there first is, so you're saying they're digging 3 feet down, all the porous concrete, nylon. So this is basically like, other than actually the visual color due to dye, this is the least possible green. Absolutely nothing could grow. We're not talking about like there's no weeds, no nothing. Pretty much anything covered by this is been not only not alive, but is preventing anything live from growing there. So it's literally almost like a little dead zone.
Absolutely. It's basically paving it. They're paving it, and, you know, there have been a couple of plans that have gone through or been presented in the past 20 years, both of which have been rejected. And, you know, our colleagues in the Faculty of Architecture, again, say that if you were going to build a building in this site, you would have to put a green roof on it to compensate for the heat island impacts, among other things.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I should add, as you said, nothing grow on it. You know, you're not allowed to. That is the manufacturer's manual indicates that you can't allow, for example, leaves from deciduous trees to fall upon the turf because algae can grow upon it, and the turf itself has to be maintained by spraying. At least the manufacturer's documentation indicates spraying a biocide against the turf, which obviously would then run off in the water, in order to prevent the growth of algae and other bacteria.
Hmm. All right. So let's move on to one. I mean, that doesn't sound terribly great, but let's move on to another issue, which is that a lot of the time, you know, institutions or organizations or cities, for instance, are left in a situation where they're left to and sort of forced to pick the better of two bad options. So to try and cut them some slack here and not make it entirely one sided, do you have any sense of what the university's perspective is this on? Why are they? Unfortunately, I wasn't able to get a representative from the university. So can you maybe do your best explanation of why they're pursuing this? What is the motivation? Why spend this money at all?
Well, sure. The university wants to make wants the space, and I should say the plan has been proposed by the Faculty of Physical Education and Kinesiology, and in effect, they would own the space. And they want to own the space because they want to make it accessible to their students. The university, and you know, to be fair, a lot of students want to play more sports and need to have spaces on campus to do so. But I don't think this is the answer to it. In other words, in fact, I think in the long run, this is not going to make the space more accessible to students. On the contrary, to make revenues out of this space, the university is already planning to rent it to outside, for example, field hockey groups. They're expecting revenues up to $250,000 a year. That's a lot of renting. On the other hand, I should say that we're not opposed at all, that those of us who are contesting the turning of the natural space into a synthetic space, we're not contesting at all the idea that it could be renovated or better maintained. Furthermore, if there's some benefit to be got from the Pan Am Games, and this project is being funded in part by the federal and provincial governments for the Pan Am Games in 2015, we would much rather see, for example, the construction of a new soccer pitch that perhaps would be less costly. I should say, too, that this synthetic turf is going to have to be completely replaced about 10 years. That is, the life of the turf itself is not forever, and it, too, will have to be torn out and replaced probably within 10 years, certainly in less than 20 years. So we would much rather see the university and the government perhaps construct a soccer pitch that could be used for the Pan Am Games, even as a practice field. So I'm not at all opposed to, none of us would be opposed to them improving space, making more use of it for student activities, but many activities, both curricular and extracurricular, will be shut out because there's a wide range of usages that you can't do on a field hockey pitch.
All right. Well, there are a couple more issues here before we get before we let you go. Unfortunately, we're running a little shy on time. One of the things I wanted to mention as well was that you did have a petition mounted on change.org. I actually found that before I read it on the notes that you sent before your own notes. It came up in one of my searches for background. So I noticed that you've got, at current, you've got just shy, unless it's changed since late last night, just shy of 3,500 signatures, including very prominently, they are featured at the top, Margaret Atwood, who's not shy at all about voicing her opinion behind civic issues here in the city of Toronto and elsewhere that she feels strongly about. How much should people take from, like, is this something where, you know, you have 3,500 and that's really impressive, but you think 10,000 is the number, or like, what sort of indication of your success or progress do you take that? Do you feel like you have had some success at this point?
Oh, sure. I think that, as you know, everyone who learns about the project, it expresses surprise. And the petition has been one of numerous ways of sort of expanding awareness. I should add that although technically speaking this plan was public access, last year when it went through governing council, very few people knew about it. I learned about it with my other colleagues and students at University College when it was presented to us only this past November. When we learned about it, we passed a motion opposing the plan, and 31 out of 34 people joined the motion to oppose it. None were against the motion, and the point is that how were we all so surprised by it if there was if it had been a transparent process before? So the petition is one way of getting awareness out. We've had very prominent members of the university community, but also, as you point out, Margaret Atwood, who's also an alumna of the University of Toronto. We've had members of government signing onto the petition. Other people who have supported us include, the city planner, Richard Florida, who also teaches at the University of Toronto. So very, very prominent alumni, students, faculty, and also just concerned citizens. That is, not only members of the university have signed on to the petition.
All right. So I'm afraid that's all the time we have for today. I want to thank you very much, Alan Ackerman, professor of English at the University of Toronto, among many other things. Thank you very much for taking your time today. Do you want to just let people know where they can access some information about this? And I want to point out as well that if you're a resident of the City of Toronto, or if you think this issue is important, please do go and check out the information there, and you can sign the petition or do whatever. But also the information that you have here, Alan, has... I think very interesting to anyone who's interested in sort of accessing university infrastructure at any university anywhere in Canada, because it can be a very tricky process here, and the information that you've sort of put together, I think, would help people understand how about to go to interact with their university on other issues.
Yeah.
So I think that would be a very good resource for just about anybody. Do you want to let people know where they can get access to more information about this?
Absolutely. We have a Facebook page, and you can find it. It's Keep the University of Toronto Back Campus Green. Keep the Back Campus Green. And on that Facebook page, you can also sign our petition, and I encourage the listeners to do so if they can. And there's a lot of posts from people like Margaret Atwood and other prominent people in Canada, and frankly from around the world, who are concerned about this, not only because of University of Toronto, but as a model for other urban developments elsewhere. So thank you very much for having me. I hope people sign the petition. Keep the Back Campus Green.
All right. Thanks so much, Alan. And we're going to take one last quick music break here. We'll be right back to finish up the program with Kevin Farmer. Stay tuned. All right, and we're back. This is Darren Kaster, your host. You're listening to The Green Majority. I hope you've enjoyed today's show. We've got just a couple of minutes left, so we're going to go back to Kevin Farmer just to see what else was on his mind. I know I sort of spoiled one of your other stories there, Kevin, but was there anything left on what you wanted to say this week?
Well, the other thing, I'm kind of stuck on the tar sands this week. It's kind of been... Like fate, the articles that have jumped out at me have all been sort of associated to Alberta oil in general, climate change, and the tar sands. And then last night,
Just before I let you continue, I should point out that I wanted to make sure nobody felt like we had any hate for Alberta specifically today. So the song we actually just came from was called "Heaven in Alberta" from Big Sugar. Just want to say. Anyway, carry on.
Yeah, that's good. We've got to keep the love.
we love you. We just don't like some of your parents' decisions. That's all.
Right. Yeah. Well, last night, David Suzuki's show, The Nature of Things, was all about the tar sands development, and you know, out of sight, out of mind. It, like, I know how gigantic the development is over there, but you know, to see it again. It from helicopters, where as far as the eye can see in every direction, the landscape has been obliterated, and there's nothing but these huge, deep pits. And it looks like National Geographic referred to the tar sands as looking like dark, satanic mills, and that set off a firestorm of controversy amongst politicians when that issue came out. But it's true. It does look just like that, like dark satanic mills. As far as the eye can see, there's nothing but ripped up earth and gigantic machines and smokestacks. And you know, it's like Dr. Seuss's picture of the world when everyone was cutting down the trees. And then we're producing the waste that's being produced is also off the charts. Like, these tailings ponds are getting larger and larger, and it's been proven that some of them are leaking. So we're not containing the waste that there is. And finally...
Before you get to finally, I was going to say, I remember that part of that article as well. And one of the funny things about it was that, I believe, was it Sierra Club? No, it was EcoJustice that was doing some of the independent study. And then some other scientists said, you know, based on their models, as long as this data that's on the input side is correct, which it seems to be, and they got it from one from their own self-reporting and one from a government resource, they said, you know, this seems to be accurate, and all that sort of thing. And the oil industry in this case response was, yeah, but we're within the law, and yeah, but we're getting better. To which my response to both would sort of be the same. What, yeah, we're getting better is so what? you know, better than what.
I'm smoking light cigarettes now.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Yeah, I'll get cancer slightly slower, or potentially just exactly the same. But the other thing was that there was thing of, oh, well, we, you know, we'd like to remind you that everything that we're doing is well within the law. Yeah, but the law just changed that basically there's no rules. So that doesn't mean anything.
But we're an environmental champion, don't you know, according to Joe Oliver.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, in the year or at least 2 years of like some of the most striking disastrous cuts to environmental regulations, having any company saying, yeah, but we're within the limits of the law really, really falls on deaf ears, I think.
Oh, yeah, that's completely offensive. But the last thing I wanted to point out is that, you know, the industry has promised that once they're done, they will reclaim the land and leave it only as, you know, they'll sort of fill in the holes. I don't know what in God's name they plan on doing with those tailing ponds, of which there are, you know, probably hundreds of them, and they're huge. These are the ones where the ducks died on, famously. The migrating ducks landed on one of these ponds and the flock died. But there's, you know, people who have looked into this have come out to say, but by the way, the cost of that reclamation to restore the land to green space is greater than the profits of the oil sands that you're getting out of it now. So essentially reclamation, even that's the other sort of thing that gets touted as a way to greenwash the tar sands. You know, and as I've always suspected it would happen, it just seems extremely unlikely that they're actually going to reclaim that land. Like, God help us if they do completely mine out all the oil in the tar sands. But even as far as they've gone, it seems like reclamation is off the table, even though that's just that and carbon sequestration is one of the things they tout to kind of, you know, to soft sell this and you know.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, one of the other things I like to point out as well is that tailings ponds is about as much of a misnomer as oil sands versus tar sands. My preference, obviously, is for tar sands. The official government rhetoric is oil sands. But, I mean, when we're talking about tailing ponds there, like tailings, people don't really know what that is. Sounds like, well, tails. I don't, you know, maybe it sounds bad, but I don't really know what that means. But then there's the word ponds. And you're like, oh, a pond. You know, like, so like what ducks go in. That's, you know, we lost some ducks, so it's a pond. You could take like day cruises on some of these things. We're talking about, by the word pond is about as much of a, you know, a misnomer as calling a 747 a paper airplane.
Yeah.
It's like, we're talking about stuff that's like kilometers wide that you can see from space. These are not ponds. By any measure of the imagination, it is completely insanity to call them ponds. Anyway, I'm afraid we're out of time entirely. I had a few other news items. As usual, all that will go up on the website, links to all this stuff, and I would be very remiss if I forgot for a second week in a row in my dying minutes here. I just remembered that Gordy Warnoff, host of the show, Junk Raiders, that's what it was. Junk Raiders is on his company, basically. Sorry, I'm getting tongue-tied here a minute in the last minute. But basically, Gordy Warnoff is the Junk Raiders from TVO. His company, A Higher Plane, is on the Live Green Toronto Awards, and he'd like some of your votes. So if you have time, go to the livegreentoronto.ca page there. You can look at some videos. Look for Gordy Warnoff's business, A Higher Plane, and give him a vote. We think he's a great guy, so go ahead and give him your support. I'll place links on the website afterwards as well, but that is all the time we have for today, so I'm going to have to say adieu. We want to thank Kevin Farmer and both of our guests today, both Katie Gibbs with Science Uncentered and Alan Ackerman with the University of Toronto. Check all the information on the website after the show, and that's it. We'll hear from you next week. Take care.